stared at her angry brother in astonishment. "How did he do it?" she asked.
"Ohm's knocked out with a broken jaw, and Nune is dead. The old bastard snapped his neck. They were just kids, those fingers. Knew enough to Jade that they could go without it. How that withered scarecrow Doru could have..."
Sudden realization swept across Hilo's features. A muscle in his cheek twitched.
"Granda!"
He whirled and strode back out of the study, nearly dizzy with fury.
"Granda!"
Shay leapt to follow him. He ignored her as he prowled up the staircase and flung open the door to their grandfather's room. Carl Sen sneered at him from his chair by the window, a look of smug vindictiveness painted on his wrinkled face. His eyes, so often weary and vacant these days, danced bright and cruel.
"Don't you know how to knock, boy?" he demanded in a raspy bark. "You!"
Hilo's eyes moved up and down, scanning the old man in disbelief.
"You gave Doru Jade! You gave him your Jade! And why shouldn't I?"
Carl Sen shouted.
"You're taking it all away from me anyway, you impudent wretch! You think I don't notice? This is all I have left!"
The patriarch pushed his blanket to the floor and flung open his robe to reveal the sagging pale flesh of his torso over a belt now liberated of most of its stones. It looked like an antique item, the belt, weathered and empty, something that belonged in a thrift shop.
"It's my jade. I'll give it away if I want, to whomever I want."
Hilo was at a loss for words. He'd made sure there was no jade in Doru's house, and that neither of the guards had any on them that might be stolen. The former weatherman might have betrayed the younger calls, but he wouldn't take jade from the torch any more than he would slit his only friend's throat. The idea that Carl Sen would give away his jade had never even crossed Hilo's mind.
"You've lost your senses," he said. "You've no idea what you've done." "I set Doru free," said his grandfather with a vicious smile. "He doesn't have to stay trapped here, putting up with such humiliation. The way you treated him. The best weatherman there ever was, a hero of the country. And you stripped him of his jade and locked him up like an animal, just like you're doing to me. Disgusting."
Hilo took several trembling steps toward the old man in the chair, too enraged to even give voice to all his patricidal thoughts. Shay went defensively to Carl Sen's side, her aura churning with agitation. She shot her brother a warning look.
"Hilo!"
Hilo stopped a few feet away, the knuckles of his fists white. His voice, when he spoke, was a whisper of loathing.
"No one in this family could be pillar after you, could they, Granda? Not Lon, certainly not me. No one but the Great Torch of Kaycon. You dragged at and questioned Lon's every step, and you'd laugh to see Ait Yu's daughter claim the jade off my body. Stay in this room, then, until you die."
He spun and left, slamming the door behind him. He came across Woon standing at the bottom of the stairs, and forgetting, in his aggravation, that Woon was no longer Pillarman, he said,
"Call Dr. True. I want that man sedated and the rest of his jade locked up. When Ohm's awake, tell him he's to guard Granda's room from now on. No phone calls or messages. If Doru tries to contact him, I want to know."
On the steps in front of the house, Hilo sat down and lit one of his remaining Aspenian brand cigarettes. They were getting hard to find. The upsurge in crime and violence was disrupting the flow of imported goods. Business was bad overall. Why had he been so stupid, so soft-hearted? And Shay, always standing up for the old fiend. Dr. True had told them that Carl Sen was sliding into dementia as his jade tolerance waned, that he was no longer cognizant of all his actions. But Hilo thought his grandfather's spiteful personality was simply more transparent now. He draped his arms over his knees and felt weariness slowly crawl over the lingering anger. It had been a bad couple of weeks since he'd made his stand in Wisdom Hall, since No Peak had declared peace to be impossible and committed the city to war. There had been some visible victories. The release of the KJA audit results had reflected badly on Ite, and with Chancellor Sohn leading the charge in publicly condemning the Mountain and wielding his influence, No Peak's most important Lantern men were maintaining their allegiance, waiting to see what happened next. What was happening was that Gaunt was winning the street war. The Mountain had apparently decided that there was no point holding back now. It didn't matter if No Peak held political or public sympathy if all its soldiers were dead. Even with his own network of spies, Hilo had underestimated both Gaunt's genius for urban warfare and the extent to which the Mountain had dug into No Peak territory by cultivating street gangs and mercenary agents that rose up to attack the clan within its own districts. Shay came out of the house and stood behind him. "I'll find Doru." Her words were stiff. "You're right. It was my mistake. I spared his life, and it'll be my responsibility to correct that."
"He's long gone," said Hilo, "and he won't be easy to get again."
"I'll get to him," she promised. Let her try. He would set Tar to the task, and he wagered his man would get it done first.
"It'll be too late in any case," he said without turning. He couldn't muster the energy to maintain his anger at her. "We have to assume everything Doru knows, the Mountain now knows. They'll know which of our businesses are most valuable, which ones are weak, how much money and jade we have, how long we can hold out in the war." He ground out his cigarette.
"Then they'll soon know it's not long." He looked over his shoulder at her, then turned back around.
"So it's bad."
Shay said, "Tourism is down over 50%, and that's hurting us far more than it's hurting the Mountain. Some of their strongest sectors, like retail, are actually doing better in the war. People are stocking up on supplies, and they're motivated to buy things now instead of waiting, in case a business isn't there tomorrow."
Woon, who'd joined Shay by the door, added,
"With the KJA suspended, mining and jade exports have stopped, so we have no income coming in there."
The Mountain would be feeling the loss as well, but they'd been hoarding jade and would have greater reserves. Shay said, "We're trading jade in the street war, but if they keep taking more from us than we're taking from them, we'll deplete our supply. We still need to make fingers out of the Academy's graduating class in 2 months.
"What about the minor clans?" Hilo asked. "Can we get anything from them?"
Shay said, "The Short Tent Clan and Six Hands Unity have lined up behind the Mountain. No surprises there. Stone Cup has sided with us. They hardly have a choice, given their dependence on the construction trade. The Josun Clan and Blacktail Clan have made noises of support, for all the good that'll do us. Lip service is appreciated, but you can't wring much juice from a grape."
There were roughly a dozen smaller clans on Kaycon. Some held sway in certain towns elsewhere on the island, or were entrenched in specific industries. Some were independent, and some were tributaries of the major clans, but none were even a sixth the size of either the Mountain or No Peak.
"The rest are acting like Hado Shield and staying clear, no doubt waiting to send bouquets of dancing star lilies to whoever prevails," she added.
Hilo stood up reluctantly and said, "Talk in the house." They went inside, and though it still wasn't his favorite room, he went into Lan's study because it was private. Shay and Woon came in after him. The books and papers he'd scattered were still strewn all over the floor. Hilo stepped over them and fell into one of the armchairs, motioning for Woon to shut the door behind him.
"Tell me how long we can last."
Shay said, "At this rate, we'll be in the red in 6 months. That's even if our Lantern men stay with us, which they've done so far.
It could be a lot less than that.
It doesn't matter what Sohn tomorrow says, and it doesn't matter if people think Ite is a crook.
Once they sense we're bound to lose, they'll blame No Peak for dragging out the suffering of the city. They'll start reneging on tributes and looking to the victors.
And the Mountain? How long can they stay at war?
We don't know, but longer than us, Woon said. If they're producing Shine and Igutan like they say, that's an entirely separate and lucrative income stream.
It's worse than that, Shay said. They're smuggling jade to the Igutanian government through secret contracts. That's how they're using some of the supply they've spirited away from the mines, to get in bed with foreigners on the other side. Between that and the Shine factories, my guess is their coffers are just fine.
Hilo raised a puzzled expression to Shay. How do you know the Mountain has secret contracts to sell jade to Igutan? Is this for sure?
Shay sat down in the chair opposite him and crossed her legs, lacing her fingers over one knee.
The weatherman reads the clouds, she said.
It was an old saying, meaning it was the weatherman's job to know things, to cultivate secret sources of information in order to stay one step ahead of everyone else. A smile crept to Hilo's face upon hearing his younger sister cite such hidebound clan adage, reminding him that a good pillar did not question his weatherman's methods or sources too closely.
Like a duck to water, as he'd always suspected.
Shay did not return his smile.
We need two things, and we need them soon, Hilo. We need money, and we need to turn around the street war. If I can get us the first, and you and Ken can get us the second, we might survive the year.
Her gaze dropped for a second, then rose again.
We also need to plan for what happens if we don't.
She was right to bring it up, but Hilo slouched farther down in the chair, leaning his head back and closing his eyes.
Not now, Shay. We're not there yet. We may be soon, she said.
I said not now, Hilo repeated.
Leave me alone for a while.
After a long moment, he heard his sister rise. She and Woon collected the spilled papers from around the room, then exited wordlessly. The door clicked shut behind them. Hilo remained motionless with his eyes closed. He considered, with a dispassionate calm that was quite unlike him, the possibility that he was outmatched. If he failed and was killed, they were the same thing as one would lead to the other. No Peak would likely perish with him. He would be the last pillar of his clan. If there had been a more fitting leader upon Lan's death, he would have stepped aside, kept the position of Horn, for which he was better suited, and done his best to win the war in that way. But there had never been any choice. Shay could not be the pillar. Certainly she was smart and carried her jade well, but the clan would not accept it. She was the youngest, a woman, and she was no Ait Mata, who had been the eldest and still came to power only by slaughtering all potential rivals. Shay would not do that, nor did she have the necessary common touch, a force of character or charisma that would compel other greenbones, the powerful fists in particular, to gladly offer their lives to continue fighting the war under her command if Hilo were dead. No, Hilo thought despondently. His sister was a study in aloof and self-sufficient competence, an able business leader, but not a greenbone pillar. She would want the position even less than he did. There were no other heirs to the clan leadership. Andon was a call by adoption, but he was too young. Not even jaded yet, and of mixed blood. Ait would probably have him executed nevertheless, to be on the safe side. The Make brothers were the sons of a disgraced Mountain Fist. They'd never be accepted as the head family of No Peak, if there was a No Peak clan to be head of by that point. Kal Sen had an older sister, and Hilo's mother had two younger siblings of little note. So there were some second and third removed family cousins scattered throughout the clan, none of them with the name or upbringing of a Kal, none prominent or accomplished enough to lead. Hilo was accustomed to the idea of death, but contemplating the extinction of his family, of his entire bloodline, and the clan it had built, shook him deeply. He thought about how he might join Lan in death, knowing he'd left unfulfilled the vengeance he'd sworn, and despaired he hadn't had enough time to marry Wen and give her any children. He thought about these things, wallowed deeply in the pain of them for a short spell, then slowly turned his mind back to the present. He wasn't dead yet. A man could be shot or stabbed. He could be fatally wounded, spurting his life out upon the ground, and still have a few precious minutes to bring down his enemy. Hilo had seen it before. Adversarial, opportunistic cunning was a horn's strength, and Hilo was a natural horn. Anything could happen in a battle. The right person with the right opening and the right weapon, that meant everything. Now, he thought after some time, I can plan for death. Chapter 49 Overture to Adamant Capita. The ferry crossing was located in a part of the docks now under mountain control. Gaunt's fists and fingers patrolled the area, on the lookout not only for any counterattack by No Peak, but for thieves and smugglers who might take advantage of the change in territorial oversight to step up their activities. When Meik Wen walked up to the gangplank of the ferry, one of Gaunt's fingers stopped her and asked to see her ticket.
You're going to Yuman, miss?
Yes, Jen, Wen said. My grandmother was born in Shosone,
a small fishing village on the western coast of Yuman Island, now a tourist town, catering to both Kekanese vacationers and Aspenian servicemen.
She wanted to be returned and laid to rest there.
Wen dropped her eyes sadly to the blue funeral urn cradled in her arms. She was dressed in a simple white sweater and a long white woolen skirt, and her face was brushed with white powder. Her heart was beating slightly faster than usual, but surely it was normal for anyone stopped by an unfamiliar greenbone from a recently conquering clan to be a little nervous, even if they had nothing to hide. This young man with the jade studs in his ears wouldn't perceive anything out of the ordinary.
Let the gods recognize her.
Looking deeply embarrassed, he handed her ticket back and said,
I'm afraid I must ask you to open the top of the urn.
Wen sucked in a breath of indignation.
Chen,
she protested.
There are many criminals these days, the finger said apologetically. We have to check everyone's possessions as they board, for weapons and contraband.
And jade. Yuman had many long stretches of unguarded coastline, and most intelligent smugglers would rather risk being caught by the Aspenians than by Greenbones. Jade scavenged in a clan war and ferried out of John Loon by boat could find its way to the Tun mainland or the Uwiwa Islands. Wen cast a look of deeply convincing insult at the mountain finger, but let her gaze drop quickly. She lifted the glazed lid of the vessel and allowed the man to peer inside. If he touched the urn or took it from her to examine it, all was lost. They would not kill her, not right away. The mountain would find out who she was and use her against Hilo. Wen thought,
I'll hurl myself into the harbor.
Both she and the urn would sink to the bottom. The young man said,
Go ahead, miss. Forgive my disrespect to you and your grandmother.
He stepped aside to let her board the ferry. Wen replaced the lid of the funeral urn and walked up the gangway onto the boat deck. Her face, resettled in an expectedly solemn expression of filial mourning, betrayed none of her relief, just as her body exuded no jade aura. She saw the mountain finger tug his right earlobe as she passed, but it was to ward off any spiritual ill will he might have accrued from examining the remains of the deceased, and not because he knew she was a stone eye. Wen held the urn closer to her chest. She no longer cared how heavy a stigma of bad luck she carried, not if it shielded her and served a purpose. Her deficiency was like a misshapen object, undesirable and unattractive in isolation, that made perfect sense when set in the right place. The other people on the boat, commuters, day trippers, tourists, kept a considerate distance as she took up a seat near the bow. The ferry whistle blew shrilly, and the vessel pulled away from the dock. With satisfaction, Wen watched the waterfront recede. She could have chartered a private boat instead of risking this ferry crossing, but then there would be a record with the make name on it, one that might be examined if she was stopped and searched by a Coast Guard patrol. This was more anonymous, the personal risk worth the potential gain. When Wen disembarked at the small harbor on Yuman Island an hour and a half later, there was a car waiting for her. Shay had arranged it for her ahead of time. Yuman Island, like Little Button, was not part of John Loon proper, but while Little Button was a minor independent municipality, Yuman was essentially run by the Aspenians. As soon as the car began driving through the small town streets, Wen saw shops with signs written in two languages, currency exchange booths displaying the current conversion rates between Kekanese dien and Aspenian thaliers, shiny foreign chain stores and restaurants, and most conspicuously of all, Aspenians on the streets, in and out of uniform. Wen felt as if she'd arrived in another country, some place that was a hybrid of Kekan and what she imagined Aspenia would be like. Of course, one often saw foreigners on the streets of John Loon these days, but nowhere near as many as there were here. Yuman Island held 25,000 Aspenian military personnel, a fact that most Kekanese seemed content to ignore so long as they remained ensconced on this rocky and wind-blasted volcanic stump of land. The clans did not control this place, but so close to John Loon, they were far from without influence. The driver of the plain gray sedan that picked Wen up opened the door for her respectfully and did not ask any questions during the drive. Wen rehearsed what she would say when she arrived. She had not, to her great regret now, learned much of the Aspenian language, and as the car drove past airfields and vistas dotted with silos and wind turbines, she spent the quiet minutes rolling the unfamiliar sounds around in her mouth, repeating what Shay had instructed her to say.
"Sir, what is your name?" Wen asked the driver.
The driver glanced over his shoulder at her.
"Eh? My name is Sedu."
Mr. Sedu was a ruddy man with a short beard and calloused fingers. Wen never forgot a name or face, and she filed Sedu away in her memory. According to Shay, the man was the son-in-law of a luckbringer who worked directly under Hame Tumashan and could be counted on to stay quiet.
"What do you do, Mr. Sedu?"
Wen asked, giving him a smile warm with true curiosity.
"I'm an electrician," said the man.
"Is that a good business to be in?"
Pretty good,"
Mr. Sedu said, relaxing somewhat. Wen suspected that when he'd been told to pick up a representative of the clan at the ferry dock and speak of the task to no one, Sedu had imagined he would be driving an intimidatingly high-rank greenbone such as Hilo or one of Wen's brothers.
"Do you do a lot of work for the Aspenians?"
"Yes, a lot," Mr. Sedu said. "They have many facilities here and are always needing work done. I have 3 apprentices now and am looking to bring on a 4th. The Aspenians pay well, always on time and in thaliers."
"You must be very busy. I appreciate you troubling to drive me."
Mr. Sedu made a dismissive motion, any remaining tension leaving his shoulders.
"It's no trouble. One should always provide a favor when possible. Different foreigners come and go, but the clans will always be here."
Wen smiled.
"Do you speak Aspenian well, Mr. Sedu?"
"Enough to get by. Not as well as my daughter. She wants to go study in Aspenia, but I wouldn't trust her to live alone in that country. Aspenian men, they do whatever they want, and there are no repercussions."
"Will you practice a little Aspenian with me now, as we drive?"
An hour later, Mr. Sedu's car pulled up to a gate set in a tall chain-link metal fence
topped with security cameras and signed with large red anti-trespassing notices. Behind the gate was a sprawling cluster of low, gray-green buildings. The flag of the Republic of Aspenia whipped loudly in the island's stiff breeze. Mr. Seydoux stopped the car before they reached the guard box. Wen got out and walked the rest of the way, holding the blue cremation urn in front of her. Yuman's relentless wind tugged at her clothes and at the stern knot in which she'd imprisoned her hair. She breathed slowly to keep calm, more fearful now than when she'd faced the finger back at the ferry dock. From here on in, her success depended entirely on the accurate judgment of Carl Shea. And while she did not doubt the weatherman's intelligence, Wen did not fully trust the weatherman herself. Hilo's sister had turned her back on the family and left Kaycon before. What was to stop her from doing so again? Wen had come too far now and had no choice but to put her faith in the other woman. She would have been even more apprehensive if the weatherman had not, at least, been honest about her misgivings. "Lan's ghost will spit on me for this," Shay had said, with such gloom that Wen had been a little surprised. She had always thought of Carl Shea as remote, even unfriendly. She suspected Hilo's sister must be feeling desperate indeed to confide in her so.
"Lan would do anything to save the family. He would be grateful to you for doing the same," Wen assured her.
The ongoing clan war was already courting the risk of Aspenian involvement. This was No Peak's chance to make a move before the mountain did. Shay nodded, resigned.
"The Aspenians aren't afraid to fight," she said. "But if there's one thing I know about them, it's that they believe anything they want can be purchased."
A guard with a pistol holstered at his waist came out of the box as Wen approached. He began to ask her a question, but Wen interrupted, raising her voice so the Aspenian words could be clearly heard over the wind.
"Colonel Dealer, please, I speak with Colonel Dealer. I come from Carl Shalinson of the No Peak Clan with a message for Colonel Dealer of Aspenia."
Colonel Leland Dealer, the commanding officer of the Republic of Aspenia Seaborne Infantry at Yuman Naval Base, was enjoying a rare moment of quiet at his desk after a morning spent on the phone. In the nearly 4 years he'd been in this post, he'd never before seen so much attention trained on the island of Kaycon. His superiors in Adamant Capita were focused on containing and deterring the growing threat from Igutan, so long as Kekanese jade regularly made its way over the ocean, the top brass was satisfied. That was no longer the case, and Dealer was suddenly getting concerned calls from top generals and even the secretary of the War Department. There was a knock at his door. His executive officer, Lieutenant Colonel Yancey, thrust his angular face into the office.
"Sir, I think you need to come see this."
Yancey filled him in as they walked.
"A woman showed up an hour ago. She asked for you by name, claims she's an emissary of Carl Shalinson."
That was a name Dealer had not heard for some time.
"Carl as in the John Loon clan family," he said.
"This woman was sent by the granddaughter?" "That's what she says."
"I thought Carl Shalinson left the country and emigrated to Aspenia.
Apparently she's returned."
Yancey stopped outside the door of a small meeting room.
"You want me to pull everything we have on her?"
"Do that," said Dealer. They entered. The woman sitting in the chair was dressed in Kekanese mourning attire and held a stone cremation urn on her lap. The colonel glanced at his XO questioningly, then back at the unexpected visitor.
"I'm Colonel Dealer, the commanding officer here."
"My name, Make Wen Rushan," said the woman, in broken but understandable Aspenian. "Carl Shalinson of the No Peak Clan sends regards."
Dealer said to Yancey,
"Can we get a translator in here?"
He turned back to the woman. She would have been checked for any weapons and gone through the metal detector to get in here, but nevertheless, his eyes fell suspiciously on the urn she was carrying.
And what exactly do you mean by that, Miss Make? The woman stood up and removed the lid of the ceramic vessel. To the colonel's utmost surprise, she tipped the contents onto the table. A stream of gray and white ash poured from the mouth of the container.
What in the...
Dealer exclaimed. And then he stared as chunks of green rock tumbled from the urn. They clinked together, landing in a dusty pile on the mound of powder that had concealed them. The woman emptied out the last stones, then set down the urn and gave a small, smug smile at their flabbergasted expressions.
Jade,
she said. Yancey whistled.
Must be worth a goddamn fortune.
Call Gavison in here, said Dealer. Tell me if those rocks are real Kekanese jade.
The translator, Mr. Ute, arrived. His eyes nearly bugged out of his head at the sight of the jade on the table. Dealer said to the woman,
Explain why you have so much jade and how you got it here.
Mr. Ute translated his question.
As the Kekon Jade Alliance is under investigation for financial irregularities, all mining and export operations have been suspended, including official jade sales to the Republic of Aspenia. We appreciate that this is inconvenient.
The woman paused to let the translator catch up, then gestured toward the gemstone spilled on the table.
The No Peak clan has its own stores of jade, and the weatherman would like to discuss establishing a confidential arrangement that would ease this sudden disruption to the supply.
Dealer's eyebrows rose. Disruption was right. Ever since clan warfare had erupted in Kekon's largest city, the military analysts in Adamant Capita had become increasingly concerned that whichever clan prevailed might assume near absolute political power. That could mean existing contracts with the Republic of Aspenia being reneged upon or unfavorably renegotiated. Kekon was vital to the ROE's military and political strength in the region. It hosted several Aspenian military bases, was a rapidly growing and modernizing economy with historical hatred of Shatar and Tun, and most importantly, it possessed the only supply of bioenergetic jade on Earth. Dealer had already been on several calls with his superiors to discuss the potential for military action to secure the mines on Kekon if things went further south.
Can you prove you're a representative of the clan? Dealer asked.
The woman's watchful gaze and the white powder on her face made her seem even more coy and aloof than the usual Kekanese female. She inclined her head and said,
Call Shay. Asked me to tell you that the cormorant can still fish.
At that moment, Dr. Gavison came in the room. He pulled on lead-lined gloves and used metal tongs to pick up one of the green rocks and examine it under a small loop. He did this with several stones.
Bioenergetic mineral structure, all right, he declared. Raw Kekanese jade.
Miss Make, said Colonel Dealer. If you'll please wait here. The woman nodded and sat back down.
I wait.
Seated in his office behind closed doors, Dealer asked,
How did she transport that much unsecured jade? She's not one of the Aborigines.
She must be non-reactive, Dr. Gavison said. It's a naturally occurring but uncommon genetic trait. The Kekanese call them stone eyes. Yancey handed a file folder to the colonel.
I pulled what we have on Call Shaylinson. She graduated from Belfort Business School in Winton last spring. Not only is she back in John Loon, she became second in command of the clan when her eldest brother was assassinated a couple of months ago.
Dealer flipped through the pages in the file. There were records and photos of Call Shaylinson from 5 years ago. As a local informant to the ROE, she'd done a few impressive and useful things for the Aspenian military, provided information that would have been difficult or impossible to garner otherwise. Dealer had crossed paths with her only once, but he recalled her as an alarming individual, a young woman wearing more jade than a whole Navy special ops team.
It had made him wonder if the ROE couldn't recruit more of these killers to their side.
Sir, did you notice her code name? Cormorant.
The cormorant can still fish, Dealer said, repeating the emissary's words. He recalled now that Call's work for them had caused some commotion at the time. Orders had come swiftly from diplomatic higher-ups to terminate her status as a human intelligence asset. That wasn't to say ties couldn't be renewed if circumstances had changed.
What of this Make woman? Do we know anything about her?
Nothing, said Yancey, except that she has the same family name as two of the top clan members. The Make brothers are considered the closest advisors and strongmen of the second Call son, who's now the leader of the clan. If she's telling the truth, she's probably a sister or cousin.
She's got to be high up in a John Loon clan to have access to that kind of jade, said Gavison. That's not stuff that gets smuggled by criminals. That's high-quality, near-flawless bioenergetic Kekanese jade, one of the most valuable substances in the world. The amount she poured out of that urn is probably worth a couple hundred million dien, 20 or 30 million thalers.
How much jade are we losing out on every month with this government suspension? Yancey wondered. What's the long-term risk to the supply?
Dealer frowned and turned to his executive officer. Make sure Miss Make is comfortable and that jade is secured. I don't want this getting out, so have a talk with Mr. Ute as well. I need to make a call to General Saker in AC.
Chapter 50 The Green Brotherhood. The severed head of Lote Penshugan was delivered to the Call estate in a vegetable crate. Hilo's howls of rage rang through the courtyard. No one, not even Shay, dared to try to comfort him. It was the third of his fists who'd been ambushed, murdered, and beheaded in the past 3 weeks. Lote Pen had not been a pleasant man in life, but Hilo counted him as one of the clan's most tireless and fearsome lieutenants, a man who, with the right word of encouragement, would do anything Hilo asked of him without question. The loss of each good fist, Lote, Niku, and Trin most recently, but also Goon, Obu, Mito, Ase, Ronu, and Sato, felt to Hilo like a personal wound delivered by Gaunt Ash directly. The methodical bastard was bleeding out no peak, killing each of Hilo's men before he came to Hilo himself. It was some hours before Lote's jade-stripped, bullet- and blade-torn body was recovered and reunited with his head. It was Make Ken's job to go in person to pay respect and funerary money to Lote's family, but this was one responsibility of the Horn that Hilo refused to relinquish. When the two of them arrived, Lote's wife fell upon the ground with noisy sobs. To be honest, Hilo was not entirely sure if the weeping wasn't as much relief as grief. He didn't imagine Lote would have been an easy man to live with. Ken pressed the white envelope into her hand, assuring her that her husband had given his blood to the clan, and the clan would always see to the family's needs. She need not fear her children ever going hungry or homeless. Hilo saw four children, a toddler, a six-year-old boy, a girl of about 10, and Lote's teenage son, Anden's classmate from the academy, standing blank-faced with his younger siblings gathered around him, still in academy uniform from having rushed home upon news of his father's death. Hilo knelt in front of the small children.
Do you know who I am? He asked them.
The girl said,
You're the pillar.
That's right, Hilo said. I'm here to tell you that your father's dead. He died because he swore an oath to me to defend the clan against its enemies. That's often the way of our kind, to die in this way. I lost my father before I could walk, and I lost my older brother only a few months ago. It's okay to feel sad or angry, but you should feel proud as well. When you're older, when you've earned your own jade, you can say,
I'm a son or daughter of Lot Penshugan, and other green bones will salute you with respect because of today. Then he stood and spoke to Lot's son. Are trials over at the academy? The young man roused his attention to Hilo slowly, as if emerging from a waking stupor. Yes, he said at last.
We finished yesterday.
Hilo nodded. The graduation ceremony wouldn't occur until after New Year's festival week, once final ranks had been determined and graduates had declared which oaths they intended to take. But accepting ceremony, the boy was a man now, the head of this Greenbone family. I'm sorry you won't be celebrating the end of trials or the New Year. Hilo's voice held an undercurrent of sympathy, but it had the rough tone he would take with any of his own men under formal circumstances. A representative of the clan will be here soon to help arrange your father's funeral. If there's anything you need from us, Lot Jen, anything at all, you call the horn directly, and if you can't reach him, you call the house and leave a message for me. The young man's face moved in a brief contortion. He hadn't missed the way Hilo had addressed him as a fellow Greenbone and a member of the clan. He glanced over at his collapsed mother and down at the small siblings huddled around him. Hilo watched the youth's eyes, which had been full of scorn and resentment during their first encounter, slowly clear of their stunned confusion and resolve into dark acceptance, into blackness of purpose.
Thank you for your generosity, Kul'jen, he said, speaking like a man,
and he raised clasped hands to his head, bending deeply in salute. As they left the house, Hilo said to Ken, That young man is our brother now. We have to take care of him and bring him up right in the clan, like his father would have wanted. Start thinking about how best to do it. Maybe put him under Vuei. He's a good mentor. Hilo's specific beliefs about what was required in a leader of Greenbones could be traced to a day some 13 years ago, when the Make brothers had been ambushed and set upon by a pack of 6 academy boys, and Ken had had his cheek badly broken. Hilo had not taken any special notice of the Makes before then. Even though he and Tar were year 4 classmates, they were not friends. The Make brothers had few, if any, friends. They stuck together a great deal, as everyone was aware that they came from a shameful family. One day, a snide remark caused Tar to attack and beat another boy, and even though he was punished by the instructors, the boy's friends, Hilo included, took it upon themselves to wait until they had a chance to catch the Makes off academy grounds. The brothers put up a ferocious defense. Hilo hung back. The boy being avenged, Uto, would later become one of his fists, but was not at the time a close friend of his, so Hilo felt it was rightfully the place of others to take the greater share of the feud. After a while, though, he felt the Makes had been through enough. The fight continued only because Tar had not suffered much. Ken, 2 years older and larger, had taken the brunt of the attack and delivered impressive damage in return. Ken's refusal to yield cost him. He was finally struck so hard he fell moaning to his knees with his hands over his damaged face. Tar's eyes clouded over with rage, and he pulled a talon knife from seemingly nowhere. This caused all the boys to stop. Up until now, unspoken rules had been followed. Only fists and feet were involved, and there'd been no pinning or beating on the ground. The appearance of a knife signaled that the fight had turned potentially deadly, and it put all of them at risk for expulsion from the academy. A ripple of uncertain menace went through the group. Hilo did not like how things were going, so he called out, "We're done!" At that time, he held sway with the group, but not so much that they obeyed him in the heat of a moment like this.
"We're not done!" Ase retorted. "We have to teach these two a lesson. They can't be trusted."
"Why do you say that?" Hilo asked curiously, for he admired the Make brothers now after seeing how well they fought and how fiercely they defended each other. He envied the bond they had, and with a pang felt that it was something he lacked,
not having a brother of a similar age. Lan had graduated from the academy the year after Hilo entered.
"Everyone knows it about them," Ase insisted. "I'm not done either," Tar snarled.
Behind the upraised talon knife, his eyes were as wild as an animal's. Hilo suspected he did not care if he was expelled for murder.
"If we're here on account of Uto, then we're done," Hilo said, still speaking to Ase. "If you've got some other grief with the makes, you should have said so earlier. I don't know of any myself. Does anyone else?"
"That's easy for you to say,"
retorted another boy, who was cupping a hand to his bleeding nose.
"I didn't see you doing much of the fighting, Call. The rest of us did it for you, and we've still got grief, all right."
A moment passed before anyone seemed to realize that the boy, Yu, had said something wrong. A dangerous light had come into Hilo's eyes.
"All right," he said at last, and though his voice had gone quiet, he was easily heard in the alleyway's sudden silence. "I can't argue with you. I shouldn't suggest what we ought to do if I haven't suffered as much as the rest of you. And it's also not fair that Ken and Tar should have to keep fighting 2 against 6 when they've already been punished and can't help that their family is hated by everyone. I'll fight the makes. If the two of them can beat me, that'll settle the matter for both Tar and you here."
Hilo shrugged out of his jacket and handed it to Yu.
"No one else jumps in, or I'll have words with you myself another day."
Everyone looked skeptical, though also undisguisedly eager. This was a good matchup. The makes were fearsome, and Ken was large, but they were both tired and injured. Hilo was fresh, and he was a Call. No one who wanted to stay in the good graces of that family would dare to really hurt him, but the makes had no reputation to lose. Hilo looked at Ken's battered face and Tar's maddened one.
"Put away the talon knife," he said, as simply as if he were asking Tar to close a window. "I'll give you 3 blows to even things up. I won't answer the first 3. After that, I will."
The makes did not argue. The first 3 blows, 2 of Ken's huge fists to the stomach and a 3rd to the face, nearly knocked Hilo unconscious. He climbed to his feet, wheezing through tears of pain, and began to fight back. At first, the circle of onlookers cheered and jeered, but they quickly fell silent. The trio of fighters were having a difficult time. All 3 were soon staggering exhausted, as if drunk, and none of them bore real hatred for the other side. Yet they kept battling on through a bull-headed, adolescent sense of perceived honor. In a matchup of jade powers, Hilo would have prevailed, but in a blunt physical contest, he could not hope to win. The Make brothers had fought together too many times, and Ken was too strong. In the end, seeing Tar gasping and barely able to stand, but readying to hit him in the mouth again, Hilo broke into a bloody grin. He bent over, coughing with laughter that rattled his bruised ribs, and Tar, after staring at him nonplussed for a second, began to laugh himself until he fell back against the brick wall. Ken scowled. As half his face was frozen from his injury, he looked like a ghoul as he went, not first to his younger brother, but to Hilo, and offered him a hand to help him upright. The 3 of them left holding each other up, the other 5 boys shuffling bewildered a respectful distance behind them, and returned to the academy, where Hilo and the makes were assigned to clean the academy's toilets together every day for the next 3 months. Looking back now, Hilo shook his head at the stupidity of 15-year-old boys. But after that, no one spoke badly of the makes to their faces, not unless they wished to challenge Call Hilo, which they did not. With the death of Lot Sr., Hilo was not optimistic about No Peak's chances of holding Sogan. Most of it was already lost, and the violence was spilling into Old Town, which only a few weeks ago he would have counted as a No Peak stronghold. He strategized gloomily with Ken in the car as they drove to the Kong Lady,
which had become one of the clan's primary meeting locations and was constantly occupied by the Horn's men. Hilo personally preferred the food in the double-double, but there was fire damage to the kitchen, and no point in repairing it during a street war when they might lose the property again. They arrived to receive another terrible shock. One of the fingers rushed through the door and down the front steps as soon as they stepped out of the Duchess.
"It's Aiden," the young man gasped, his face a sickly hue.
Trembling, he led them into the bedding house and down the stairs. The silent crowd of fingers in the hallway parted, pressing against the walls as Hilo and Ken came through. Aiden was lying, moaning, on a black leather sofa in the basement lounge. Both of his arms were missing, chopped off, the stumps at the shoulders cauterized. Someone had brought Dr. True. The portly green-bone physician was bent over, hands on the man's chest, channeling into him. Aiden wept.
"No, stop, get off me,"
twisting his armless torso to try to push the doctor off. As Hilo stared down, shaken at the sight, Dr. True stood and wiped his perspiring brow.
"That should keep him alive until he gets to a hospital. An ambulance is on the way."
"Hilo-Jen,"
Aiden sobbed, and Hilo crouched next to him.
"Help me, please. He wouldn't give me a clean death, wouldn't even give me the respect he at least gave Lote and Sato. He sent me back alive to give you a message."
Hilo bent near Aiden's face.
"What was God's message?"
Aiden's gray eyes burned with fury. He looked as if he'd spit, if only he could sit up.
"I don't want to say it, Hilo-Jen. It's insulting. Not even worth you hearing."
"That disgraceful piss drinker crippled you for this message," Hilo said. "Tell me what it is, Aiden. I promise on my brother's grave I'll take God's jade for you."
Still, the man hesitated, his bloodless face slick with sweat.
"God says he'll give you until the end of New Year's Day to surrender yourself. If you do, he'll grant you a death of consequence, on your feet and with a blade, and let your family bury you with your jade. The rest of No Peak will be spared if they can choose allegiance to the mountain or exile from Kaycon."
Aiden drew a difficult breath.
"If you refuse, God promises to keep sending you the heads of your fists, and he'll do worse to Anden and Shaijin than what he's done to me. He means to burn the torch's house to the ground and destroy the clan completely."
Aiden saw murder sweeping across the pillar's eyes, and he lifted his head in sudden urgency.
"End my life, Hilo-Jen, and take my jade for the clan. I'm useless to you now. I'm a green bone, a fist of No Peak. I can't live like this. Please!"
Ken made an inarticulate noise of agreement behind the pillar. Hilo's fog of wrath cleared long enough for him to lean forward and place a hand on the man's brow.
"No, Aiden. Right now you're humiliated and in pain. You shouldn't make the decision to die in the state. All you're missing are your arms. There are good prosthetics these days. The Aspenians make them. You still have a sharp mind, and your training, and your jade abilities, and a wife. You have a beautiful wife, and a baby growing in her belly. You shouldn't die if you can help it."
"She can't see me like this,"
Aiden sobbed.
"I can't let her."
Hilo turned to Pano, the finger who'd brought them in. "Go tell Aiden Jen's wife that he's been hurt. Make sure she stays at home until he's ready to see her. Get her whatever she needs, comfort her that he'll be all right, but make her stay at home. Go, now." He turned back to Aiden as Pano rushed off to do as he asked.
"You should live to see your child be born. And wouldn't you like to be alive when I tear the jade from God's body on your behalf?"
Uncertainty slackened Aiton's face. Hilo said, "A new year is around the corner, so I'll tell you what. Give it 1 year so you can see these good things coming to you. At the end of this next year, if you still want to die, come talk to me. I'll honor your wishes myself without question. I'll see that you're buried with your jade and that your wife and child are taken care of." Tears rolled from the corners of Aiden's eyes and pooled under his head on the black leather under the bright lights of the casino.
Do you promise, Hilo-Gen?
On my brother's grave, just as I said. Slowly, Aiden's breathing eased. His jade aura calmed, the shrill spikes of desperation and pain ceasing. When the ambulance arrived, Hilo stepped away to let Dr. True and the paramedics take the man away. Ken went out to speak to the ambulance driver to make sure the fist was taken straight to John Loon General in the Temple District and not any of the lesser hospitals. When Ken returned, Hilo asked everyone else in the room and the hallway to leave. They did so in a solemn hush. Hilo poured two shots of Hoji from behind the bar and put one of them in front of Ken. "Drink," he said, and downed his own glass. The liquor burned his throat and warmed his stomach, settling his taut nerves. When Ken set his glass down, Hilo said, "Shame on you, Ken. It was a good thing I was here." Ken was taken aback. "What did I do?" "You would have killed Aiden like he asked." "Seemed like the merciful thing to do. It was what he wanted. To make his wife a widow and for his child to be fatherless? No, what he wanted was his dignity. I promised him that. Now we don't have to bury another fist. We've lost too many people as it is." He rested his forehead in his hands for a moment. 9 of his best fists slain, and 1 horribly maimed. Dozens of his fingers dead or crippled. Hilo looked up at Ken. "I expect you to honor my promise to Aiden if I'm not alive to do it. You need to tell Juen about this, Fuei too, so one of them can honor it if you're not alive." Ken nodded, but he looked frustrated. It was unlike him. He was usually stalwart, even in dire situations. It was Tar who would show his emotions, who would vent on behalf of both of them. Now, however, Ken's soldierly composure was visibly fissured. He understood all too well how badly the war was going, and how that failure could in large part be laid at his feet. The Elder Make's tired face was rigid with the baleful desperation that Hilo remembered so well from that first memorable encounter when they were both teenagers.
"I wouldn't have thought of saying what you did to Aiden just now," Ken said in a gruff voice. "I can't do what you do, Hilo-Gen. You have to learn to be the horn. I'm giving you a hard time, I know. If Lon were here, he'd be tearing into me for everything I'm doing wrong as Pillar." "But he's not here," Ken said, and Hilo heard the resentment, realized that Ken saw the difficulty inherent in his position so long as every jade warrior in the clan still looked to Hilo as the true horn when he entered the room. There was nothing to be done for it, though, not with the stakes so high. He had confidence that given autonomy and time to find his footing, Ken would be more than capable as horn, but Hilo was also grimly aware that he couldn't afford to step away right now. A wartime horn needed not only the respect, but the love of his men, needed empathy in addition to cunning and resolve. As Nopeak's position became increasingly dire, it became more and more important that the Greenbones saw him among them and kept faith. "Soon I may not be here either," Hilo said somberly. Ken's head jerked up, the frown on his face sharp. "You're not thinking of giving in to Gaunt's threats?" When Hilo didn't answer, alarm began forming on the horn's face. "Like Aiden said, it's an insult not worth listening to. Does Gaunt actually think you'd hand yourself over like a sheep to the butcher? We've killed many of theirs, and he's trying to scare our fingers with what he did to Aiden."
"Maybe," said Hilo, but he didn't think Gaunt was so superficial. No, the man must be aware of the important fact that Shay had told Hilo and that Ken did not yet know. Based on respective clan resources, the Mountain would eventually win the war. But it would take time and be bloody and costly to both sides. The Mountain would be a weak and gutted victor by the end, perhaps unable to manage all its territories or maintain the support of its Lantern Men and the Royal Council. Smaller tributary clans might break away. The jade smuggling and SN1 manufacturing businesses Ait had built would be at risk from takeover by criminals and foreigners.
"He's trying to force an end to this," Hilo muttered.
Even if the mountain was